Well, good evening one and all, and a very warm welcome to Dr. Rock's radio show on msiradio.com and scotlandisfree.ning.com. That was Land of the Giants playing Best Days. Coming to you live this time from the Truth Juice Gathering down near Stonehenge, where I've been but a bare few hours really, and I've already met a whole load of very interesting people. One of whom is Lawrence Main, who's agreed to come and chat to me. Good evening, Lawrence.
Good evening, Doc.
he's here to do a couple of talks. Most of us are doing two presentations, and Lawrence is going to be talking first of all about Lays, and then about King Arthur's Camlan, the last battle of Arthur. And so we're hopefully going to have 15 or 20 minutes on each of those subjects. Later on in the show, Santos Bonacci will be joining us. So we'll be talking about very much land-based things for the first bit of the show, and then we'll be talking about the planets and the gods afterwards. It should make a nice balance. But Lawrence, you've been, there's quite a lot of confusion about Lays, and I'm aware that you're aware of this, so I thought we might take this opportunity to maybe tidy some of them up. But you've been looking into this pretty much for a lifetime, haven't you?
Yes, and it's a very simple natural experience to me. It really begins with walking. Walking in the countryside is a spiritual experience, a spiritual exercise. You can't get enough of it. Don't bother reading books yet. Mm-hmm. Go out there and walk and see these places we're talking about. Touch these stones. Look along the line, the lines in the landscape, the patterns from a holy hill, and feel the magic in the land. And this is really where it all began in me. The books came afterwards. Mm-hmm. And principally, of course, I presume to say, of course, the book that many people associate with Lays is The Old Straight Track.
Yeah.
By good old Alfred Watkins.
Indeed. Now, one of my guests last week was the first book he mentioned, Steve Giross, talking about stones and telluric currents, and that was the first book
he mentioned. Still think it's the book anybody interested in Lays must start with. You can easily criticise it and say the deficiencies, but there are good reasons for those things not being in there. They'll perhaps get to those in these 15 minutes.
Yeah.
But it is a masterpiece. No one else has come up to old Alfred's shoulders.
It's
I'm including people like John Michel and Paul Devereux, but Alfred Watkins was the lay hunter supreme.
And it was a groundbreaking book in its approach to the countryside, wasn't it?
It opened people's eyes. And it's nearly 100 years ago that it was written. Published, what, 1925, I think.
Yeah.
And Alfred Watkins was an old man, older than me. I'm 63 now. I've got my bus pass. Well, Alfred Watkins, I think he was older than me when he wrote that book. Mm. And it's a product of his journeying around the Herefordshire countryside, amongst his many other activities. He's a stalwart, upright citizen of Hereford, living near the cathedral. That's a significant thing. Living near the cathedral in Victorian times, because he was born in the reign of Queen Victoria. His book came near the end of his life, remember. Mm. And he could not be, it was a very different climate in those days. You couldn't, well, it was also a very different legal situation. You still had the Witchcraft Act. Dowsing, for instance, could be considered to be witchcraft.
Is that right?
You could have been banged up, let alone being shunned by the rest of your peers, the people who were living near you in this cathedral city where old Alfred lived, right near the cathedral.
Mm. Yeah.
Upright member of society.
It's difficult. Maybe it comes as a surprise to some people to find that it's a mere 100 years or so since that was the case.
Well, you had to be very careful what you said. So what we're getting from Alfred Watkins is what he was able to say. Able to say in the sense that he would not be breaking the law or being shunned by the people in society who were his neighbours and friends. And it is a very, let's use the word conventional, in that it looked at it Well, it started off with Alfred travelling around the countryside using his eyes. He also was a photographer, so he would look with photographer's eyes. He invented a special, I think it's a light meter. He would go around the countryside with a brewer's dray. He knew he was steeped in Herefordshire and the Welsh borders. And the story is that one day he was over at Blackwardine Crossroads, and he was casting his eye over the land, and he had a vision of a chain of like fairy lights of the what we call ley markers, sacred sites, a holy well, a standing stone, an old church, Scots pine tree, clipping the edge of an old hill fort, whatever. He had a vision of all these things all being lined up, and each point would be like a fairy light on a Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm.
And he suddenly had this vision all in one go. It's revealed to him, a revelation. Actually, I've been back to that crossroads of Blackwardine, where interestingly today we think what in terms of spirit paths for days and the dead. Good thing seems to bury people on the lay. There is a green graveyard there where you have your green burials. Mm-hmm. On that very spot.
Oh, is there?
That very crossroads. And I doused Alfred's lay. And the way to really see it, understand it, was to douse, because it was not a spectacular view where you would look with your eyes along the line of a lake. It was not a holy hill with the surrounding countryside laid out before you like a map. So I just wonder at the truth of this so-called revelation, is how he had to put it. But I doused there. And interestingly, the lay I doused was exactly the same as Alfred Watkins, clipping the edge of a hill fort, going for that crossroads at an angle of 320 degrees, which immediately meant to me major lunar standstill, and linked it with a goddess.
Mm-hmm.
And here we're coming into the modern aspect of this. Alfred Watkins wrote in his book about traders' routes, old straight track.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a lot of evidence there, which is still very valid. Place name evidence, linking it with ancient gods like Mercury. Merchants travelled along these lines dedicated to Mercury, bringing their merchandise to market. And these routes had marker stones along them. You get the mark, the merch. So he's got a lot of relevant things there, but he didn't go to what we could say the otherworldly, the spiritual aspects. But they're there. They're workmanlike lays. I don't think it's an either or situation. It's an and. These were old straight tracks, although where you came to difficult landscape, you didn't go straight. Although sometimes interesting you do, but it would be natural to curve around a bog or a rocky mountain and then resume on the other side. And also, it is a strange fact in my experience that when this lay would come to a river, it would do so at a ford.
Yeah.
Now, this...
Which suggests that at least one of their main reasons was for navigation and travel.
It also suggests to me that these things were not just enhanced or put there by human beings who could have erected standing stone, who could have doctored the riverbed somehow so it's easier to cross, but also that nature or the earth goddess might have had a hand in this, that the goddess, nature, knew that this is where the river should be fordable.
Mm-hmm.
It all fits.
And because of these little kinks to get round, to get to a ford or to get round a bog and stuff, it's why why ley line is not always a very accurate way of describing them, is it?
You just committed the cardinal sin.
I thought I might. I don't go on.
Because I have a rough shorthand is, do people know what they're talking about with lays? And they talk about ley lines.
Mm.
Ley lines? People talk about ley lines? They're ignoramuses. Read Alfred Watkins, and there is no mention of a ley line. They are lays. By definition, a ley is a line. It is a straight, allowing for curvature of the earth, of course. But that is irrelevant when you're talking about a day's walk of 20 miles. It's not going to curve that much. So straight line of alignment of ancient or even modern, but sacred sites, such as standing stones and holy hills. They often aim at a holy hill, a beacon hill. Reason why the beacon was put there, because it was marking the lay. And holy wells, I said how churches can be built on these. Ancient churches certainly are. Holy wells, all sorts of edges of, often clipping the edge of a hill fort, a so-called hill fort, which is another debatable matter, but these features in the countryside all line up in straight lines. They are alignments of ancient sites. A lay is a line by definition. So Alfred Watkins talked about lays.
So does the line that runs from, say, Land's End through to Hopton along the Beltane sunrise, is that a
lay? I've walked that, or at least I've walked that, and the lines I chop and change each day according to my mood and what seemed the most interesting route. Because there is a straight lay. I prefer to call it the dragon line.
Yeah.
And when I doused it, it would have a blue colour washing into my third eye. And coiling around it, these later lay researchers, we come up to 1989 of Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst writing
Sun,
The Sun,
Sun and the Serpent.
Sun and the Serpent. Mm. This is the first time this was revealed. And it also opened a great gulf in the lay hunting community, because Paul Deborah, the arch lay hunter, editor of the Lay Hunter magazine, refused to accept it because it involved dowsing, which is a very subjective thing. He was aiming for academic credibility and trying to show how lays, straight lays, using computers and so on, could not be there by chance. He was confounded by these dowsers, Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst, dowsing lines which are not straight. And a lot of people talk about lays or lay lines when they mean these wandering lines, which are something different. They certainly exist because I've dowsed them. I've dreamt on them. Amazing, strange things have happened when I've dreamt on them. Mm. And they are male and female, it seems. Michael and Mary. Mary, when I walked it, was a green colour, and the Michael was a red colour that washed into my third eye as I doused. And I call them earth currents. Mm-hmm. So that's just, they do exist, no doubt about that. Perhaps they're wilder, and the lays have been tamed, say, like George taming the dragon. Geo. George, Geo, the lad.
Yeah, yeah.
And pulling taut these lines so they're dead straight, nice and tidy and efficient, yeah. Whereas wild natural lines would coil around. Or maybe they're like the double helix coiling around the central spine.
Because they do snake either side of the line, don't they, the Michael and Mary?
They do indeed.
And they meet at various...
And at times they cross. All three lines could cross. One occasion, when I walked this, was in December 2009, I walked it from Carnley Boyle near Land's End to Hopton in Norfolk, just over the border from Suffolk.
Mm-hmm.
Through places like Glastonbury Tor and Avebury, Bracelet Edmonds. But one place I reached at full moon, I think it was the 2nd of December 2009, was the Hurler's Stone Circle on Bodmin Moor. And I reached there fairly early, about 2 p.m. And it started to sleet, which was a lucky thing, I think, for me, because I wanted to camp there. And there were lots of dog walkers around. When the sleet came, they cleared off and I was alone. The visitor centre was shut, of course, being December. And I wanted to sleep in the centre of this stone circle, where Hamish Miller had written his book, The Dows, the Michael and Mary Currents, and they lay all crossed.
Right.
And this was a
in the centre of the circle,
there. Centre of the there's three circles there, it's the centre of the middle one.
Okay.
And it had poured of rain that autumn. Everywhere was soggy. And my feet, I squelched into towards it. I thought, oh dear, how am I going to camp in this? And I found
camping
right
on Bodmin in the middle of the winter, you're a hardy soul, aren't you?
In this saturated land. And I reached the point I wanted to camp at, just by a stone in the middle. Not many stone circles have stones in the middle, by the way, no, but this one had. It had a pond around it because of the rain. They'd had floods just a few weeks before, greatest, biggest floods in history or something in Cornwall, but and I'd witnessed the effects of this. I'd sunk up to my knees in mud one day, carrying my backpack. I had to be hosed down by a farmer's wife. But I got to the exact spot, and lo and behold, there was like a 6 foot by 3 foot space that was dry. I could camp in it, the very spot I wanted to camp in it. I pitched my tent. That night, I had the most fantastic, well, the next morning, about 5 o'clock in the morning, say, I woke up after the most fantastic dream. In my dream, the goddess, I knew she was the goddess, she was actually dressed as a druid with a hood, but I knew who she was, I'd seen her in previous dreams at other places, offered me a cup filled with a red crimson liquid. Could have been wine, could have been blood. Anyway, she offered this cup to me to drink. And in my dream, I was about to drink it. I suddenly had this awful dilemma, this great question. Should I drain the cup or should I sip it? Which would be the right, the polite thing to do? Well, I'll tell you what I did in a minute. If we have time, I must say.
Oh, we do, yeah.
But I woke up with this awful dilemma. Had I done the right thing? Okay, the question was immense. Should I sip it or should I drain it? That happened there, that night.
Yeah.
It was one of many dreams at these sacred sites on these lays.
I know that Fred Gillam last week said that that's one of the ways that nature communicates with us is through our dreams.
Oh,
he was talking specifically about trees, but I know he's...
Definitely so. And also dreams at sacred sites.
Yeah.
You can dream at home in your bed, of course you can. But you try dreaming, especially in a full moon or another special night, say, like summer solstice or be able to know or whatever. Yeah. A special time at a special place when you're doing a special thing like a sacred pilgrimage, walking in lay. You've been doing it for day after day. Anyway, I woke up with this dilemma. I still won't say what I did until I'll tell you what happened next.
Yeah.
I walked down from there and passed, I hit a lane, a road, for a short while. I noticed a signpost, it said, Riddington. Riddington? That didn't ring a bell with me. Anyway, I carried on. And I broke my pilgrimage when I reached Crediton in Devon at the summer. At the winter solstice, when it was snow, I went home and resumed it to the new year. And waiting for me at home when I got there for my Christmas reading, or Yuletide reading, to review, was a book by Paul Broadhurst and Robin Heath.
Another very good man, Robin Heath.
Yes. Yeah. I forget the title of it now. It was about the Cornish magical landscape of Cornwall and Arthur in the landscape and so forth. I'm not doing a very good job promoting their book.
Oh, well, there you go. We can't always
published,
remember it.
It was published in 2009 by Robin Heath and Paul Broadhurst.
But somebody in the chat box wants to go looking for that, and they can find it.
I read it to review it, and I reached page 200. I think it was on Boxing Day.
Yeah.
And there was the story of the Riddington Gold Cup. Because, now I read this after I jumped there on the 2nd of December.
Yeah.
There was a burial chamber nearby between it and the cheese ring, which is on the lay, which I also been to. I passed this tumulus or ruined tumulus because there was a legend to it that it was the grave of a druid who would offer a gold cup to wayfarers, pilgrims.
Brilliant. Nice dream.
And they would drink from it. There was, of course, one proviso. They had to know what to do, whether they should drain it or to sip it.
Right.
The legend said they were to sip it. Anybody who was to drain it would go mad. And a lord, apparently, did deliberately go there to be offered this cup by the druid. He drained it, and his horse went mad, I think, and it cantered away over the rocks and jumped off a cliff and dashed the lord to his death on the rocks.
Sorted.
Definitely unwise to drain that cup.
Yeah.
I'm glad to say in my dream, I sipped it.
And
but the dilemma, the question was very real. And I did not have the benefit of reading that book until 4 weeks later.
And the question came from the dream world into your waking state as well. You were still concerned with it.
I woke up with it. I was really stunned, wondering, had I done the wrong, it was the right thing. It was such a powerful dilemma. And that gold cup exists. You can see it today at the British Museum. And it served, before that, in the 1940s, it served as King George VI's shaving mug. Now, this is mixing legend, dreams, with reality, with history. This is very real. That question is very real to me. Very real indeed. I'm so glad I sipped that cup.
Yeah. When you were navigating the lay, could you navigate by eye along it?
Or, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Lays, Alfred Watkins' book, The Old Straight Track, is really a product of the Victorian era, where we thought we had progressed, that great Victorian word, progress.
Still in vogue now.
Those people in the old days were nasty, lived nasty, brutish and short lives.
Yeah.
And nobody built a road until the Romans invaded, of course. Mm. All this nonsense, which we know to be really false, but people still believe. It's what they're taught in school. History began with the Romans.
Yeah.
You look on the old survey maps, and our boys and girls down in Southampton, where they're published, they must still believe that because they've got all these roads on the map, old roads marked as Roman roads.
Mm.
Never mind the fact they were there for thousands of years before the Romans, and that we know that King Mamertius in about 500 BC repaired those roads. We still think that ancient man was inferior to us. I would say they were far superior.
I think they had some very tidy methods. I read an excellent book about, it was called Megalithic Empire, which suggested that these were used as means of getting around the place, not just for trade, because obviously they're, I mean,
they were indeed used for trade. See, when I douse and I dream, and I get this mystical side to lays, which is very important. I do not discount the practical element that people who don't douse, who just want to be able to get from A to B.
Yeah.
See, it is very true. It is not either or, it is and.
It is, when you think about it, it's a great way of being able to get around, to know that you've got these kind of long lines of sacred markers that you can work your way through, and you don't need the map and you don't need familiarity with the territory, because presumably there must be a bit of a feel to them as well. If they're using regularly kind of wells, churches, edges of hill forts and stuff, well, it must have worked as a kind of...
We have more so many things today to help us navigate. Latest, of course, being like things like GPS, which I don't touch.
No, I mean, I'm still using maps.
I do love my maps.
Yeah, me too.
I've got hundreds of maps. And to me, they are a great delight. And they are a product of the Victorian age.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the Victorian age that people, just as you had scientists labelling things and deciding that there was a Stone Age and a Bronze Age and an Iron Age and a Paleolithic and a Neolithic and all this, categorising and putting us all neatly into boxes and deciding they knew everything. This was the age, of course, when we sent missionaries all around the world to convert the natives. We were also mapping the countryside for the first time. And even in doing so, we had the first, first recorded contact with Lays, because the Director General of the Ordnance Survey himself noted there was an alignment of sacred sites. It was either going from Stonehenge to Avebury, or I think it was the Lay going from Cheerbury Hill through Salisbury onto Stonehenge. Oh, they're all in a straight line. The map shows us, though. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And so this is where lay hunting really began, with maps. Because before you had a map, people didn't know that these ancient monuments lined up, and you could get your pencil and your ruler and draw lines on these maps. So does that mean before we had maps, people didn't know there were lays? Well, of course not. There were lays. Place names. With all the place names ending in lay. They're there. People did that. They kept it quiet. They knew. They had intuition. Things which modern society is driving out of our psyches. They in the Middle Ages, certainly, people were quite happy to believe in other dimensions, other worlds, because they lived cheek by jowl of them. They knew these were real things. We have lost that ability because we've become less and less psychic. We're doing so now, dealing with radio and electricity. It's changing our bodies, changing our reception. To me, the mind is just a filter. It's filtering through from the greater mind out there. God, if you like.
Yeah.
Or goddess. Yeah. The great spirit.
There's many
universal names. Subconsciousness.
Yeah. The great architect, and the geometer. Yes. There's many names for the same
and
thing.
And we have this filter. And we're open in different ways, because now we're using electricity and all these rays coming from computers are hitting me now. I can't work with these things. And in order to protect ourselves from this dense energy, this base form of spirit, because it's all the same stuff, eventually, spirit, but it's a dense, degenerate form, we have to put barriers up and shut that filter. And in doing so, in order to work in front of that computer, to protect ourselves from this dark, dense base energy, to protect ourselves so we're not ill, we're shutting out the good. And so we're preventing ourselves from receiving the higher spirit as well. We're becoming a less spiritual society, a less psychic society. It's frightening.
Yes.
In the old days, people were much more receptive to spirits.
Yeah.
Much more psychic.
The ancient sites are still there, and we can still access this stuff to an extent.
The framework, the decayed, neglected framework is still there. What intrigues me is how much has been lost. If we can find out what we have done, we can do from what's there, then I think we really have lost a lot. And also, the more we investigate, the older it becomes. I was walking in the Pacelli Hills at the summer solstice and dowsing, and everything was pointing not to 2003 C or 3000 BC. It was pointing to 8, 9, 1000 BC. Mm. The age of Leo. And I'm now told that the latest from finding from Stonehenge in the car park, a pit in the car park of Stonehenge, suggests that there was a wooden pole or something in this pit, which is dated to 8000 BC.
That's right, yes, indeed, that's correct. There were solstitial markers at Stonehenge 8000 BC.
About the time
BC,
we were concluding this as we were walking the Pacelles. In fact, we also think we found the site of one of the blue stones there and why it was taken from there, from that specific spot, next to another stone still there, which is shaped like the head of a lion.
Right.
For Leo.
Yeah.
Anyway, we were saying about maps and Alfred Watkins and how the Victorians mapped the country and they could see these lays. So that's why Alfred Watkins, a product of his time, Victorian age, he was able to write his fantastic seminal book,
As you've pointed out, which I think is a really interesting point, and it hadn't occurred to me, he could only write about it in certain ways. There are maybe several things that he would have written.
I suspect that old Alfred was pretty psychic himself. He may have doused, but he could not acknowledge that fact. He could not tell the bishop.
No. Like you say, Paul Devereux's done a lot more work on lays. He's also done work. Didn't he run the Dragon Project? Didn't he run a dreaming project?
I first slept on the edge of a stone circle, the Rorate Stone Circle, in March, early March, in the snow, early March 1980.
I love the
Dragon Project.
Oh, you were part, Devereux, brilliant.
Part of that. And I was having to count background radiation. Counting the blips or something, and all very scientific and dull and deadly. I did not enjoy it, but I did it. But what I had as a bonus was there was a site dowser. Her name then was Beulah the Strange. Now, I think she's still around. I know this is the Beulah in BSD, but not the Strange. So perhaps she's married and changed her name. Can't be many Beulahs in this world. But she doused, and I had never doused before. I expect there are lots of people in this world who've never doused. You've got to do sometime. And I asked her, she said, you can borrow my rods. I used rods then, I don't bother now. And I doused. I just asked the question, where is the lay? I thought of a straight line of light, like a sunbeam.
Yeah.
And I found it's very easy. The rods crossed where the lay was. I doused several lays at Rorite Stones, and I could even mark them on the map. And Buno accompanied me that evening. He said, that's very interesting, Lawrence. Come into the hut. There was a hut there in those days. It's been vandalised since. And inside this hut was a map drawer, a great big drawer for old 6-inch thermal, or even 25-inch thermal, the old Victorian maps, which I also like to work with.
Mm.
And Beulah the Strange...
25 inches to the mile?
Oh, yes.
Wow,
yes,
I didn't ever see one like that.
Yes, I used to actually work the 6-inch thermal, the more practical. My guidebooks I'd written, I drew my base maps from these old 6-inch thermal maps. One reason being that I had a copyright, so I didn't have to worry about that. I would just draw my maps up on top of them.
Yeah.
Beulah had drawn lines on these maps, marking the lays that she had doused. My lines, my map, corresponded with hers. With great joy, straight away, I knew I could douse.
Yeah.
There was the proof.
Brilliant.
And I acquired some dowsing rods, and I was away dowsing everything from then on.
Now you use the human instrument rather than rods, do you?
I did have a spell where I used my arms, so I would have them in front of me. I'm demonstrating this to all listeners.
As his arms held out right in front of him, he does.
And when I came to the edge of the lay, they would snap across, just like rods.
Oh, really?
Would do.
Excellent.
And it did work.
At that point, his hands snapped inwards and went over at each other.
I would call that my vegetarian phase because... I was vegetarian for a few weeks before I realised, I hated trying to bake with an egg. I've never had eggs in my life. I just didn't like them. And I never drank milk or used butter in my life. And what am I doing this for? Of course, I should be vegan. So I went straight to being vegan.
Yeah.
So I did this for once or twice, and then I was dowsing, walking the Michael line, or the Dragon today, and my rods are in my backpack. And because I was carrying, walking was easy, it's carrying the heavy backpack is the thing. Mm-hmm. And so I could dream on the sacred sites, not go to a B&B or whatever, go to places like the Herder Stone Circle on Bodmin and the Sleet, and be rewarded with the odd dream. And my rods were in this backpack, and it was a nuisance to keep taking it off and taking my rods out. And I found I didn't need to, because I realised that as I was hitting the lay, my third eye was washed with blue. As I was coming to the Mary current, it was green. Michael current, it was red. And I learnt to trust this all the way along this lay to Norfolk. And I would stop and check the maps that Hamish Miller had given me, showing where he had dowsed. And hey, yes, I've stopped here precisely where Hamish dowsed that Michael current, and I've got red flowing through my head.
So we might say they're a means of both physical and spiritual navigation.
Why should there be a distinction between physical and spiritual?
Because there's so many people who think it's an either-or, and we're saying here it's a both-and.
Well, the ultimate conclusion about lays is that the earth is a living being, an earth goddess. There is a spirit in this land. And it seems to be a good thing to work with that spirit. Our world is pathetically ignorant and primitive, yeah, compared with those of the ancients who knew this.
I agree. It seems they, to be being kept
they
deliberately dumb.
Didn't need to go destroying the planet. It is a culture which has been based largely, I have to say, on the book. The written word, the Bible, the Christian church, which, even though the followers of the way could dispute this, if you look in Genesis chapter 1 verse 29, for instance, and God gave every herb upon the face of the earth which is bearing seed, and every tree of which is a fruitful tree yielding seed, for you it shall be as meat. So it's quite clear in there that we're supposed to live off herbs and fruits. But they have this awful word, dominion, where we were given dominion over this planet.
Yeah. Translation,
and that
is
has been
careful.
Translated as we should exploit it.
Yeah.
And we've done this all around the world when we, not only in this country, of course, it's been depleted of its woodlands. Lays were the first. The name lay is akin to blaze. Put a B in front of lay, or lays, you've got blaze.
Yeah.
And it was a glade, a woodland glade. It's where we had this primeval forest, this natural climax vegetation, mostly oak woodland,
yeah,
other trees. And we would want to see our way through it, aiming at a holy hill, and it was natural to blaze a path through it. Mm. There we have our lay.
Yeah.
That was what lay was originally, when we lived in the woodlands. Well, we've chopped them all down, or 95% of it, whatever it is.
Yeah, I think Fred reckoned last week maybe we got 14% wood.
You've only
and
got...
of that, only 5% of that 40, only 5% of the 14%, which is a tiny amount, is actually ancient wood.
Well, I know that Dr. Malcolm Smith in the 1980s did a survey of Snowdonia National Park. National Park, I said. Mm-hmm. And only 1% was the native oak wood and the natural climax vegetation. 1%. The 1% that survived because it runs on steep slopes,
yeah,
gorges and so on, where it was too steep for a plough and too steep for a sheep to nibble.
And difficult even to get the wood out of there.
And yet, if we had those trees, we would have so much going for us, not just the hazelnuts and the other ancient Britons ate acorns, by the way. Soak them overnight to remove the tannin. That's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Soak them overnight. Don't go and eat your acorns, as you worry, make yourself ill. But we had food, we had fruit, we had soil, because those trees bound the soil. The fertility of the land was enhanced also by the leaves that fell every autumn,
yeah,
and they oxygenated the air. I'm not talking about leaves now. I better get back to the subject.
That was a really great discussion about the leaves. I'm going to come and listen to your talk on it, because I know that I'm free when that's happening.
The key thing to remember is that leaves show that the earth is a living being. They are channeling the spirit of the living land to bring fertility to it.
And it's exactly those currents that Steve is investigating. The man we were talking to last week is starting to investigate what it is people were doing with stones and these energies and all the rest of it.
Or what those stones, those energies are doing of those people.
Yes.
Because we are dealing with something very intelligent. The patterns in our landscape are not wholly created by humans. We are serving the greater goddess. One is the significant example I might have time to say. For instance, you need something sacred in the Bristol Channel at the precise point where Lundy Island is.
Yeah.
I don't think even the biggest giant in the old days of Albion could have placed Lundy Island where it is. I think that the living earth knew that's where it should be and put it there. So.
That's very good. Thank you very much, Lawrence. I really enjoyed that. We'll have to do the Arthur thing later on in the weekend, perhaps. We can have a chat about that. But I really enjoyed that. Thank you very much. Thanks very much for joining us. I'll put on a couple of tunes whilst Santos and whilst we have a shift change on the guests. And I'll catch up with you a little bit later. Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
Nostar.
Let me just, hang on. I'll just find my way back to a broadcaster. That was Lawrence Main. I think we'll be hearing a bit more of him, and he's given me a couple of things to read as well. I'll just play a couple of tunes whilst we sort things out here, get some water in, get Santos in. I think Vicky from Truth Juice Birmingham's here as well. Might have a couple of words with her. So we'll be back with you very shortly. In the meantime, here's two or three tunes.